On February 10, 1861, Jefferson Davis and his wife, Verena, were taking rose cuttings in their garden at Briarfield, the Davis plantation on the rich bottomland along a looping bend in the Mississippi River. 3 weeks earlier, just recovered from an illness that had kept him in bed for several days, Davis had resigned his seat in the United States Senate when he received official word of Mississippi's secession from the Union. He and his family had made their way home slowly, stopping on January 28th at the state capitol in Jackson, where Davis learned that he had been named Major General of the Army of Mississippi. It was a position congenial to his desires. As a graduate of West Point, an officer in the regular army for 7 years, commander of a volunteer regiment in the Mexican-American War, Secretary of War in the Franklin Pierce administration, and chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs, Davis had vast and varied military experience qualifying him for such a position. He immediately set to work to reorganize and expand the state militia to meet a potential invasion threat from the United States Army. Davis also anticipated the possibility that the convention of delegates from 6 seceded states meeting in Montgomery, Alabama, might choose him as general-in-chief of the soon-to-be-created Army of the Confederate States of America. But for now, he was careworn and exhausted. He wanted only to get home to restore his health and energy, supervise his 113 slaves as they prepared Briarfield for the year's cotton planting, and relax by working in his flower and vegetable gardens. While Jefferson and Verena were taking rose cuttings that pleasant February day, a special messenger arrived from Vicksburg. He handed Davis a telegram. Verena watched her husband as he opened and read it. His face blanched, she recalled. After a few minutes' painful silence, he told her, as a man might speak of a sentence of death, that the convention at Montgomery had unanimously elected him provisional president of the Confederacy, not general-in-chief, but commander-in-chief, with all of its political as well as military responsibilities and vexations. He did not want the job. He had expected it to go to Howell Cobb of Georgia. But the convention, anticipating the possibility of war with the United States, had chosen Davis in considerable part because of his military qualifications, which none of the other leading candidates, including Cobb, possessed. Despite his misgivings, Davis's strong sense of duty compelled him to accept the call. He prepared to leave for Montgomery the next day. On his way to the Confederate capital, Davis gave 25 whistle-stop speeches. While he publicly expressed hopes that his new government would remain at peace with the United States, he told Governor Francis Pickens of South Carolina that he believed a peaceful solution of our difficulties was not to be anticipated, and therefore my thoughts have been directed to the manner of rendering force effective. One such means was to threaten the North with invasion if it dared to make war on the Confederacy. "There will be no war in our territory," he told a cheering crowd in Jackson, Mississippi on February 12th. "It will be carried into the enemy's territory." At Stevenson, Alabama, 2 days later, Davis vowed to extend war where food for the sword and torch await the armies. Grass will grow in the northern cities where pavements have been worn off by the tread of commerce. When he arrived at the railroad station in Montgomery on February 16th, he pledged to the waiting crowd that if the North tried to coerce the Confederate states back into the Union, the Confederates would make the Northerners smell Southern powder and feel Southern steel. More soberly, in his brief inaugural address on February 18th, Davis referred 5 times to the possibility of war and the need to create an army and a navy to meet the challenge. If passion or lust for dominion should cause the United States to wage war on the Confederacy, we must prepare to meet the emergency and maintain, by the final arbitrament of the sword, the position which we have assumed among the nations of the earth. Davis and the convention delegates, who reconstituted themselves as a provisional Congress, suited action to words. On February 26th, the new president signed a law creating the infrastructure of a Confederate army: ordnance, quartermaster, medical, and other staff departments modeled on those of the regular United States Army, with which Davis was familiar from his years as Secretary of War. Subsequent legislation provided for the enlistment of volunteers to serve 1 year in the Provisional Army. They were to be organized into regiments by states, with company and sometimes regimental officers elected by the men and appointed by governors. Brigadier generals would be appointed by the president. Under this legislation, a small army, and even a navy, began to take shape.